right, this is Pure Decking, the only live show exclusively made for Galaxy 15 Radio, which we have still not taken 24 hours yet because I am lazy, and it turns out trying to schedule and come up with shit for a radio station and, you know, live my life and all that, you know, it actually fucking takes time. For some reason, I was thinking I would do this in my sleep, and I was wrong. So tonight we've got with us Suave, Heavy, Fox, and the BSV. The only BSV that we know of to win that fight with the truck. Anyways, now, last week we were starting to get into some cool stuff, but we didn't get to the topic I wanted to talk about, and it's actually my fucking show, so we're going to talk about what I want to fucking talk about. And, right, there will be cussing. So if you have small children, make sure they hear and get the pronunciation correct. So, and did I lose my call? Is it dead? I don't hear anybody.
No, we're here.
Yeah, we're here.
We're here. Okay.
We're trying to be polite.
I'm not talking. Used to that with this crowd.
Well, no, we're used to totally wigging the fuck out if somebody interrupts his intro.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nah, you see, I don't do that. I just go, oh, that is the wrong button.
It's a fail.
It's a brand new controller. I just got done building it. I'm still a little bit high from the solder fumes. I do this. So, yeah. Anyway.
So, on to Metasploit.
On to Metasploit. That's right. Metasploit is actually my day job. I use that day in and day out to test shit. Specifically, I'm testing system builds to make sure that standard issue off the shelf script kiddie shit can't break into them.
Right.
But, you know, I've been looking at some of the stuff and talking about it, and a lot of people seem to think that hacking is this almost mythical, and I hate the word hacking, by the way, you want to be honest. I hate it. It's a meaningless fucking word. It doesn't.
Well, if we go back to Stephen Levy, it was a bunch of model railroad geeks.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, but, I mean, it's actually a meaningless fucking word. What are you doing? I'm hacking. It doesn't tell you shit. It's just something they say to look cool on TV. I mean, are you breaking into a system? Are you writing code? Are you soldering something together? Because guess what? All of that shit meets the definition of hacking. I don't even think of myself as a hacker. I think of myself as an information security professional. So there's a major difference in mindset there. And I don't know. I mean, I just, the word itself pisses me off. What do you all think?
Yeah, it's just too blanket nowadays.
Well, I mean, it's gotten such a bad stigma is what it is. Because, you know, like, to me, it's more about just doing things with technology that's not the norm, whether it's hardware, software, whatever. It's not necessarily a negative term, but I think that the media and everybody is, and movies especially, have really turned it into something where it's basically they're going to steal your credit cards and your social security number and steal your identity and fucking, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, there is an actual aspect of that to what I do, you know, information checking to see if you can actually get to this stuff. But, again, I don't even like the word. It pisses me off these days because it's meaningless. It's like, I don't know, I'm trying to think of an equivalent. I'm sure there's some out there, I don't have one coming to mind at the moment.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
It's like saying
terrorist.
Say what?
Terrorist.
Yeah, he's a terrorist. Well, what does that mean? Is it a suicide bomber? Is it just, you know, someone with kind of brown skin who speaks a certain language?
Was it a Christian that blew up an abortion clinic?
I don't know if we would want to really combine the two words here.
Well, you've actually got a fair point, though, in that it's a poorly defined word, and it lets them basically get away with whatever they want. Because whereas I do have a problem with the people strapping bombs to their kids and saying, go blow up blow up the infidels for Allah. I've got a problem with that. But, you know, by the same stretch, when you're calling anybody with a beard and, you know, dressing in one of those dresses a terrorist, there's a problem there, too. So,
but you get back to somebody who did swatting, right? You know, oh, it's a horrible terrorist. He made a fucking phone call, and he spoofed the caller ID in, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, cyber terrorist. That's the most bullshit term I've ever heard. It's actually more accurate than hacker, though, because at least it describes what they're doing. They're fucking with people.
Well, yeah. I've got a lot of issues just with the word terrorist, because it's basically can be applied to anyone who doesn't agree with you.
Why don't we call it what it is? Did they steal something? Did they break and enter?
Well, yeah, when they're sitting there applying that word to every fucking thing, and that's my point about the word hacking, is it gets applied mm-hmm. to pretty much anything with a computer that somebody who is not a computer person doesn't understand.
Yeah. Mm. And you know, if somebody does go and, like, let's say, steals a credit card, they shouldn't be called a hacker. They should be called a thief or possibly a scam artist or something along those lines.
Con artist is actually the most accurate.
And it would be, a much more accurate description. Instead of this vague blanket term like terrorist.
Yeah, but saying we busted up a con artist string just doesn't sound good on the 6 o'clock news.
But they want to have an excuse to tack on more years to crimes just because they have electronics involved.
Well, pretty then much. You go to the legislator and say these punishments need to be more severe. I mean, come on.
It's still just like one of those blanket terms that's gotten a bad rap, kind of like, you know, like a cult or fucking paganism or something like that. You know, it's always gotten this bad rap about, you know, oh, that must be bad. Like, no, not necessarily.
So, all right. Hacker, much maligned, poorly used word.
Pirate, yeah.
How about Metasploit?
Well, Metasploit is actually a toolkit. It's a framework. It's written in Ruby, which it was originally written in Perl, but they looked at Perl code and decided, oh, God, what the hell were we doing? And so they rewrote it in Ruby. And it is essentially a toolkit for testing known security problems and then making use of them. A major part of the framework is just the collection of modules it has, specifically exploits and then payloads. And there's really only one payload worth talking about, and that's Meterpreter. But in short, what you do with Metasploit is you test a machine to see if it contains a real problem. Like, for example, what I've been doing with it lately is I've been doing large-scale sweeps of the network for the place I work. I don't want to mention the place I work specifically because I don't want them to have anything to do with the radio station. And it's not because I even think they'd have a problem. It's more I don't really want to talk to the legal team. But it's called the hassle of it. That's why we're all using pseudonames, by the way. it's not that I it's not that I think they'd have a problem with what I'm doing or saying here. It's I just don't want the hassle. So
yeah.
But anyways, where I work, I've been doing large scale scans of the network looking for common problems. But just because something shows up in OpenVAS or Nessus and says, "Hey, you, it looks like you've got a problem here." Well, when you go to whoever runs the system, and this is the weirdest fucking thing, by the way, when you go to whoever runs the system and say, "Hey, I've got a problem here. There's something wrong on your system. I think somebody could use this to do something bad to you." Usually, they don't believe you. They go, whatever." So, if I was a fire marshal and I walked in a room with somebody with the same attitude, and they and I said, "You know, hey, that's a problem," and they said, "No, it's not. I don't believe you." Okay, fine. You light the building on fire to prove to them that it's a problem. That is the best analogy that I've been able to come up with. Seriously. So Metasploit actually exploits the flaws in a system to prove that there is a problem with them. And then you take the main payload, at least for Windows machines, in the case of Meterpreter, and use that to then start testing other things, because you can use Meterpreter to start doing what they call post-exploitation. That's where you're now into the box. You start looking to elevate your privileges. Maybe you get the system account if you're a Windows box or root on a Mac or a Unix box. And then from there, you start looking to, well, I can pivot through this system and then start attacking other systems. Very commonly, you can get into web servers through one way or another, and they usually are what's called dual-homed. They're in a DMZ, so they can talk to both the internet and then the private internal network. So you then pivot through the web server and start going after their internal network and finding more problems. Now, this sounds very evil, very hackerish, and yes, this is what hackers do. And that's why Metasploit exists. It is not for the bad guys. It is so you can test using the exact same tactics as the bad guys and see if it works or not. This is the exact same reason the TSA periodically sends people who work for the TSA with bombs onto airplanes to see if they get caught. And their safety record is not very good. So, anyways. But
You're saying security isn't supposed to always work right away?
Yes, that's right. We bought the little magic box and we put it in the corner and it says security on it. So now we have security. No, it doesn't fucking work that way. And that's another conversation I've had way too many times.
So have you played around with the unstable module tree?
A little bit. I can't use that stuff at work very much because they really don't want me crashing systems. I play with it at home a little bit, yeah. Actually, what I've been playing with lately and I'm really enjoying is Armitage. Have you looked at that at all?
No.
Oh, you need to look at Armitage. It saves you so much typing. And you still have to. It's a GUI that actually sits on top of Metasploit, and it's actually pretty rad because the guy who put it together, he knew what he was doing. It's the cheesiest fucking piece of software you've ever seen. It's got an anime chick for a mascot. When in the first video he did for it, he put this high end techno background music on it. I mean, he's totally going for the cyberpunk thing, right? Like, and when you root a machine, the little icon in the database display changes from just a little monitor with the logo of whatever operating system on it to having it turns red and has lightning bolts all over it. It's the cheesiest thing you've ever seen, but it's actually a really good interface because you can it establishes a little bit of workflow for you, which is kind of handy in a tool like Metasploit because you know you can get yourself confused as to what step you're on. It keeps everything nice and neat in a, you know, database. And it has multiplayer mode.
Armitage is actually an anime.
Oh, yeah, no, but
yeah.
And that might even be where he took the name from. There's a couple of different places he could have taken the name from. But I'm referring to a Java application that is actually, you can actually get it at fat, and of all things, like I said, cheesy, right? He actually registered the domain fastandeasyhacking.com and points that for his software. And it really is a nice tool. It really is. So I'm worried about it being a bit of a script kiddie tool, and I'm talking with the agent. He's definitely going to be using it in some new videos he's working on. But yeah, it's nice. So I don't know. Have any of you guys ever played with it?
I haven't played with it. I've seen some videos of it, and yeah, I'll definitely agree with you there on the interface. It's just badass, and I'd really, really like to see a lot more software done in that sort of style, preferably darker and more matrixy would be even better. But
well, I'm thinking about getting a hold of the guy. I'm thinking about getting a hold of the guy to suggest that he allow a plug-in architecture to Armitage because. One, I really want to get a recording of the agent saying system exploited or something so that every time you pop a new box, it plays that sound because that would just be badass. But two, I mean, something else with modules, you could make it look more matrixy. You could add more functionality to the interface, and I think he would get a lot of traction doing that.
Right.
Absolutely.
Fox, you ever played with Metasploit or Armitage?
I have not. They sound like good times, though.
Oh, yeah, definitely good times. Well, you know, I might have the agent set up something for us. I know he's working on a kind of almost a capture the flag scenario he's going to be using for one of his videos. I might convince him to let me borrow that setup for some multiplayer stuff we can play with later.
Sweet.
But that is actually another really nice feature of Armitage is it has what's called multiplayer mode, or I think he called it multiplayer mode in one of the manuals. I don't know if that's actually still what it's called. But you run a server that is where Metasploit actually lives. And then everyone runs Armitage clients and connects up to the server. And you're all working out of the same database. And you can share sessions. So you can actually split your group up into teams where maybe you've got one guy who's really good at doing the post-exploitation, digging through systems and finding files, finding ways to use this kind of stuff, you know, looking for the all-important password set XLS. And, you know, you have somebody else actually doing exploitation and actually popping new boxes. So you could have an actual set, you know, team sitting there working on a job where you've got, you know, guy A who's opening up new machines and then guy B using guy A's shells to dig through the machines. It's really fun.
That is cool. Actually, I'm looking forward to the future. HP is putting WebOS on all their printers. That could be great fun.
Oh, printers are already a fun target. I was actually dealing with a printer issue today. You know the large-scale copiers, they put mail servers on those fucking things?
Yep.
And you know they don't turn off when you turn them off on the web interface? Mm-hmm. And they act as open relays? And then people call you complaining that they're getting all this weird junk in Chinese? Yeah. That's great fun.
Yeah, I've messed with a few printers while war driving before. That was, I just wish I got to see the people's face when they woke up in the morning to 50 pictures of Goatsy on their color printer.
Oh, see, now that's just cruel because, you know, have you looked at what ink costs? It's one thing if it's a laser because then, you know, they get a lot of print out of it. And then when they wake up and there's, you know, I don't know, the Anonymous Manifesto or something on their printer just because it's funny. But, I mean, if you're printing out, you know, high glossy pictures of Goatsy, like 50 copies of them, that gets expensive quick, man.
Oh, yeah. That was the worst thing we did war driving. Normally we just, like, rename their router to, like, you know, Ass Clown or, you know, I Heart the Cock.
Yeah, but, I tell you, I did some war walking with a Windows Mobile PDA I've since gotten rid of. We actually got into a Best Buy Wi-Fi network with it. I didn't even do anything. I just had a buddy of mine with me, and when I got into it and I realized, oh, God, their router has a default password on it. And so I got into the admin interface, handed the PDA to my friend, and, of course, the look on his face was fantastic, and just walked away, kept shopping. He did a bunch of stuff. He set a password on it, changed the name to something vulgar. It was great.
If Marty was still here, we went to some mall there in Brisbane and walked in. He was like, oh, hey, look, they got a new Windows 7 machine sitting out for display. You know, try to log in as admin. Oh, they haven't, you know, changed the default blank admin password.
Winning.
Yes.
Yeah, we made a hasty exit from that mall after that.
had to practice jumping over the fence and ditching the laptop in a trash can, huh?
Pretty much.
Yeah, if you ever get to an auction, these printers are fun. Usually 40 to 80 gig hard drive nowadays.
Oh, yeah. You can get them on, can get old hard drives on eBay, too, if that's what you're looking to do. So, I don't know. I enjoy the tool. I thought we might have some more to say about it. I didn't know.
Those of us that don't get to play with that stuff so often. I mean, I've just started to put my own network together.
I gotcha.
You know, I gotta say, I'm a lot more interested in like war driving and stuff like that. I always have a lot of fun with that too.
Driving was fun a few years back when people came up with it, but now, I mean, everybody has a wireless router. You can't hardly buy an access point that's not.
Yeah.
So.
And most people are getting wise to WEP now, so it's not just, oh, look, Linksys, I'm in.
Yeah, but I'd say the number of unsecured routers out there is probably about the same, because you've got the number of users increasing at the same time as the user awareness is increasing.
In my area, AT&T is pretty prevalent, and they do full encryption by default.
Actually, when I got my cable internet, because, you know, as we were talking, I just recently switched my internet access to get away from AT&T because of bandwidth caps, and we can talk about that, too, if you want. But we'll be going to the break here in about five. No, we can keep going. Anyways, but the guy, he obviously... He did a good job installing it, real nice and neat installing everything, but it was obvious when it came time to set up the router, he didn't really know what he was doing. He was following his glossy checklist, and I said, I looked at him and said, dude, don't worry about it. Just get the cable modem working with your laptop there. I'll take care of it after you leave. And he looked at me for a second. He goes, huh? I said, don't worry about it. He goes, well, okay, I need you to sign a few things here. And I looked at it, and one of them was that my email access had been explained to me, so check. It's like, yes, I know how to use email. And I was going, and the other one that got a chuckle out of me was, I was going to secure my Wi-Fi network. And I looked at him and said, are you serious? He goes, oh, yeah, we have to make sure you lock it down. You are going to put a password on it, aren't you? So I showed him my 128-character random password, because I didn't care. It's not like he was going to remember it, right?
Yeah.
And the guy just goes, What, really? I'm like, yeah. And he goes, why? I'm like, because nobody's fucking cracking it. He goes, you can crack Wi-Fi? It, like, never occurred to this guy. It's like, oh, man, if your password is puppies and somebody's driving around, it's not that hard to start checking for common passwords. And this guy had never, you could see his face. He had never considered the concept of brute forcing before. And it was like, what, you mean just, like, sit there and try to guess a password? I'm like, yeah. That's what it is. I mean.
Yeah.
That's why I'm a big fan of misspelling words.
We're not terrible spellers. We just want to keep a secure network. I like it.
Unfortunately, we use our encryption on everything.
What'd you say, Fox?
I'm not typing in lead. I'm just securing my password better.
What'd you say, BSV?
I said, unfortunately, we use encryption on everything.
Well, in seriously,
that's not how I encrypt my email. Fuck.
Encryption.
That's not encrypting the email. That's just getting around all the spam filters because, you know, Viagra is spelled wrong. Yeah. Actually, though, speaking of passwords, if you are going to encrypt something on your hard drive, your passwords.xls or password.txt, because I can't tell you how many times I've gotten into a system and they're like on the desktop, passwords.txt. And it's like, oh, game over.
Yeah.
It's like, excuse me, sir, we have reached the game over condition. And they go, what do you mean game over? As in game over, as in I win.
And, yeah, you should never keep your passwords, even on your computer. Keep it on a piece of paper, man. Like, that way nobody can get to it remotely. Here's something. Yeah, that is the ultimate network security piece of paper.
Oh, okay.
Even if you like make it into a text file and you heavily encrypt it with a 128-character password, and somebody gets a keylogger on your system.
Well, you know, that's true. That's why if you're going to keep a text file or an Excel spreadsheet or some sort of a database program with your password, just don't store it on your hard drive. Store it on a thumb drive and keep it in your pocket. Keep it, in the laptop bag, but go ahead and encrypt it. That way, if something does get in your system and starts dumping out files while you've got it hooked up, you know, it's one more layer. But if you do have to save this stuff, at least save it out on a thumb drive, right? That way, most of the time, it's sitting not hooked up, and it's just as good as a piece of paper. The other problem, though, is I see this a lot, because what are 90% of computers out there these days? They're laptops.
Yeah.
And my favorite is, you know, people used to take the Post-it note, write their password on the Post-it note, and stick it under the keyboard, right? Well, just because the computer's a laptop doesn't mean they don't still do that. And so it's always great when you're going into meetings and you see somebody with a laptop under their arm and the mailing label stuck to the bottom with all their passwords written on it. It's like camera phone, click.
We had to go through HIPAA training again at the hospital I work at. And they said one of the stories is somebody took a bunch of medical records home on the laptop from work so they can, you know, get caught up during the weekend. Well, the sticky note inside the laptop containing all the passwords got left on a subway with the laptops.
Ooh.
All that data. It was like a $3 or $4 million fine.
Oh, yeah, because they fine you the full fine for each individual item.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, HIPAA compliance is insane. But it's what you have to do to get people to secure their networks. I mean, you have to. You know, if you're dealing with that kind of stuff, you don't play games with it. You have to encrypt the laptops. You have to require good passwords, and you have to have good policies for using this kind of stuff. But the problem with that is it's really inconvenient for, say, your nurse who's been a nurse for 20 years, who when she was in training never had to deal with computers and passwords, and doesn't. They just don't get it. They just don't understand why your password needs to be 30 characters long and not make any sense.
And you're dealing with civilians who don't have to follow orders.
Very true.
That and they get all butthurt when they have to change their passwords every 90 days. And so what do? They write them down on their ID badge.
Oh, that's a class. Well, I mean, it's just like when people write, you know, if it's like RSA tokens. Same thing. Where do people keep them? They keep them in the laptop bag. Well, what do you do when somebody grabs your laptop and runs?
Yeah.
I mean, keep them on your keychain. Keep them separate. That's the idea. That's, because it's always fun to rag on security now for this stuff. he got Gibson got really excited, and I mean really excited. And like I said, Steve Gibson's a great engineer, terrible security practitioner. Well, not terrible, but I mean, he gets really excited about the wrong things. But like, he got really excited that the latest Intel chipset, what is that, Sandy Bridge, is going to have a chip in it for like doing those little RSA style key fobs, which RSA got hacked recently, by the way. I don't know if you all knew that. Apparently somebody was in there and they got the encryption code or something, because RSA is now putting out things like, yeah, don't share the serial number on the back of your token. Oops. But Gibson got really excited about the idea that they were going to build this right into the chipset, so now the laptop would have a hardware ID. And it's like, wow, that so completely defeats the point of having it as a separate piece of hardware that you can't interface with without a screwdriver and a soldering iron. Because now you get malware on your laptop, which is how they get your password 90% of the time. They get the keylogger, they get the malware on your laptop, and it's like, oh, well, they don't have the laptop, so they can't generate the key. Well, no, but they control the laptop, so they can induce the key anytime they need it. And and this is what will tick me off about Gibson, and you can tell he's an engineer when he does this stuff, is somebody actually pointed that out to him in a letter. I got mad listening to it. I actually had to turn that podcast off and wait for about an hour before I could listen to the rest of it, because he was so wrong on that, right? Mm-hmm. And somebody emailed him and basically pointed that out. And his response was, well, that's not what that was designed to defend against. That's a very engineer-centric answer. And he's right.
Yeah.
It wasn't designed against it. But it's still a security problem. I mean, that's when you give that kind of an answer to a security problem, it's... I mean, I don't know how else to respond to it, you know?
Failing.
I don't have that button. We'll cut you out of saying failing, Fox, and we'll make that
right.
The sound clip.
Awesome.
So, well, it's just about time. We're gonna go play some music here, take a little bit of a break. When we come back, Heavy, you want to talk about Mesh?
Absolutely.
All right. Awesome. We'll move into that here in just a few. Okay, we are back, and watch as I stall while saying, I think we're ready to go, and it's a good thing, too, because I was going to be playing this if, you know, we need another song. And watch as I stall as I remember to call you back up on the call. There we go. There we go.
You brought him back from the dead.
Sweet.
Anyways, we'll hang on to that for the end of the show. So, I got the call back up, and where were we? Heavy, you wanted to talk about mesh networking, right?
Yeah. So basically what I'm thinking is this. We need an internet that anybody can access without control by the corporations or necessarily governments. But people need to get paid. And so basically, I was thinking about using IP headers with a timestamp,
which is already in technology. I'm going to stop you for a second because you just did something that pisses me off.
Okay.
You said the corporations.
Sorry.
Saying the corporations is like saying the Canadians or the cars. It's a classification of a business.
Okay.
We all know when you say the corporations, you probably mean specific large multinationals with questionable ethics.
Why don't we just say the evil corporations? Because then you're only referring to the bad people.
But I'm not saying
evil.
Well, we got to define what the evil ones are then, because there's some corporations out there that do some very good stuff, too. It's just that's a personal bugaboo. It pisses me off every time I hear somebody start going, oh, it's all the corporations. Well, which ones? There's a lot of them out there.
You mean not all big businesses are evil?
Well, they're actually amoral.
Well, the thing is,
true.
Winning.
You know, I actually expect a lot of the existing companies, communication companies, to support a lot of the infrastructure. But I want the little guy to get paid, too. And so
That's cool, man. Keep going with what you're saying. It's just that's kind of a personal bugaboo that if somebody says the corporations, I say, well, which ones? Because there are a lot of them.
But to get back to Tuesday's episode, you know, paying by the bit. Say I've got a, you know, wireless node, and I'm transferring bits, and my timestamp's going to go in there. The technology's there. And so we just need to add a little payment data to that. So, you know, and then I figure anybody can do it. You're moving everybody else's bits, and you're getting paid.
So you want to track payment via the IP header?
Yeah.
Okay, so what do you do when I build packet system to generate crafted packets that have, say, your ID, and I start spamming?
Yeah. Okay, that's a good point.
The way Bitcoin runs it, I think that's pretty much what you're talking about, isn't it? Like a virtual currency? Or is this going to be about generating, like, real-world dollars?
Yeah, it was kind of going to translate into real-world currency. Bitcoin actually used the processors to work on an algorithm.
Yeah.
And I don't want to put that kind of overhead on the web.
Well, no, it doesn't have to be processors or anything. You can have the generating mechanic work a different way. But what I like about them is basically the money is stored as a physical file. Like an actual file. That is completely encrypted. There can be only one for each, like, dollar, let's say. And it's done in such a way where, like, if you actually lose that file that's got the encryption key on it or whatever, that money's actually gone. So it actually behaves a lot more similar to actual physical currency. But in doing so, it makes it seem a little bit more secure in the generation of it anyways. And I think that sort of concept could be applied here.
Well,
so I'm really bad at describing how they do it.
What Bitcoin does is they run a large, I guess it's kind of a pseudo distributed computing system to generate very specific encryption keys based off of fudging the results of hashing together a whole bunch of the previous ones, so that you can actually follow the chain back and figure out whether or not somebody's created a valid, I guess you'd say, piece of currency. It's just a file. But and it's also handled in the system in such a way that it doesn't, it doesn't get duplicated. Now, I'm wondering about hacking that, you know.
And I'm sure a lot of people have been trying. I've looked into it, and I haven't found anybody who's actually done it yet. But of course, if they have, they wouldn't be telling anybody about it either.
I'm almost thinking, as opposed to bothering going after their math, because their math is probably really good, because it was actually a mathematician who came up with this stuff. So I'm going to assume his math kung fu is mightier than mine, and instead just go after his damn servers. But,
It would probably be easier to go and actually steal the bitcoins from the users as opposed to
using
their service.
I hadn't even thought about that.
You could just hack individuals, especially individuals who have a lot of bitcoins.
Well, wait a minute. Didn't the Bitcoin client all work through IRC as well?
It's possible.
I think that's how they're communicating the clients to each other, is through IRC. Game over. It's pretty easy to get somebody's IP off of. Then you're just checking for problems. Or you, hey, check out this great PDF on how to generate more Bitcoin. Don't be evil. Don't be evil.
So the problem my idea is basically one of overhead, you know, proper encryption, you know, timestamp, randomization, all of that important stuff. Mm-hmm. And I don't have the skills to do that myself.
Well, actually, there is a way to do what you're wanting to do. You're talking about being able to track each packet on the internet back to a individual user for billing by the bit, right? Across, say, mesh networking?
Basically.
There is a way to do that. The problem is you have to re-engineer most of the internet to make it work. Basically, as opposed to putting something in the packet header, you actually do an encrypted signing. And we already have the software for doing that, for doing digital signatures based on two-way encryption, asymmetric, okay. I should say. I am a security professional. I do know the terms. I just don't care to use them. But if you sign each packet with this, with a digital signature using asymmetric encryption, which is basically how SSL works, by the way, if you do that, you could then track each packet. But there are other, you say, well, we'll just use that for billing. But what do you do when you put a listener on there and you're working for, say, the Chinese government, and you can track back everyone who's ever said anything bad about you, just as an example? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's major privacy concerns with that.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there a better way to do it? I mean, could we put currency in the actual packets to pay its way to get it until it gets to its destination?
Well, no, there's not a better way to do it at the moment, because TCP/IP, which is a protocol that runs the internet, was never designed for, hell, it wasn't even designed for encryption, but it was never designed for tracking, really. I mean, the only way it has to track is basically by trusting the clients to be honest. Now, with the TCP side of things, it has to be honest. You have to give them a real address, because otherwise you can't make a connection. But with UDP, you can just spray packets out on the internet. And things like proxy servers totally break that. So, I mean, there's just too much stuff out there that already exists to try to go back after the fact and implement some sort of a metering system. I don't know how you do it. I mean, the ISPs have a shot at doing it because they're the connection point, right? They could actually put some sort of a digital meter on there. But that raises...
I was going to say, you put a postage packet on, or postage header on each packet signed, and then as it goes along, it pays its way?
Well, I suppose you could do that, but again, you're really relying on the system, everyone playing in the system, to be honest, and you think spammers aren't going to just game the system and charge all their packets to somebody else?
Yeah.
I mean, and that same stamp system you're talking about, what if I set up a router that, as you go through, it rewrites all the stamps to be back at full postage again? I mean, you're either talking everything back to a central server, or you're trusting every endpoint and every client, which on the current internet is impossible. Hell, you can't even do it on a tightly controlled, you know, like a CipherNet. You couldn't even trust every endpoint. Bradley Manning will tell you something about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's
I don't mean to bring up politics, but
like
it's a good example.
3.5 million people on a network. There's just no way to control it.
Well, yeah. that's kind of the point of the technology, and that's why so many places are banning it. That's why you see India going after. Oh, hell, they've been beating up BlackBerry now. I think they've said they want everybody who has any kind of encryption system to give them a backdoor. And yep. Most people are looking at them like, we can't. It's not designed that way. Mm-hmm. Was it the FBI, I think, was wanting all kinds of backdoors as well. And everyone was basically telling them, sorry, you're too late. There's no way for us to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You can look at the encryption now. It's already out there. If they outlawed tomorrow all the encryption, well, okay, I've got a copy of TrueCrypt on my hard drive from when it was not illegal. What, you know, am I supposed to delete that?
Oh yeah, well, it's just like think of it of like anything else that's online that's illegal, like
bestiality
or something like that. You know, yeah, that you can't. It's out there now, and it's just out there forever.
I mean, you can try to make it subversive and push it underground, but really the only way to get rid of something on the internet is make sure everyone loses interest in it.
Yeah,
and then wait for any servers that it might be left on to die.
Mm-hmm. That's about it. And yeah, you can do some keyword filtering and stuff like that when you've got your internet totally cracked down like some countries do. But then people will just call it something else.
Well, sure, you call it something else, or you go through proxies, or you use Tor.
Yeah.
I mean, there's... Yeah. The problem is the people making the rules don't understand just what is possible with the technology. And that's because the people who are inventing the technology are still inventing it. They're still figuring out new ways to do shit. I mean,
exactly.
You know, I mean, oh, encrypted proxy servers, they exist now. How do you filter that? Well, you block all of them. Well, that gets hard because they go up and down so often. Oh, we'll just do whitelists. Oh, yeah, that'll work. So, I mean, you know.
It's difficult. Maybe we'll just have to start with, you know, WiMAX and the... you know, open frequencies and see how far we get.
Well, a better way to do it, actually, is to, you know, you started out the conversation by mentioning mesh networking. Now, mesh networking equipment is fairly expensive, but if the price on it was to come down and everyone was to run a mesh networking node in their house, like, you know, most people run Wi-Fi nodes today. And you could build a mesh networking node, go buy 3 Wi-Fi routers, and you can tie them together and make a mesh network. It's not hard. But,
oh, yeah, and it's only expensive because there isn't a big demand for it. If there was a more of a demand, it would be manufactured more, and then the price would be down.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm just hoping to get something that has, like, 10 miles before the signal hits the ground.
Well, that's the idea with mesh networking is the range isn't very long, but you have a lot of nodes. So... You know, if you build little solar stations that have a battery pack, a solar panel, and a mesh networking thing on it, and stick them every, oh, what's a good range on those, 200 yards? I mean, that the price on that's expensive, but if you can cover an area in these mesh networking nodes, the mm-hmm. only cost associated with running the node is the electricity once the hardware is paid for. There is suddenly no cost for bandwidth, no cost for connectivity, no cost for maintenance on the wiring, which is mostly what you're paying for these days. So bits would become free if you did that, basically.
Well, to an extent, but you got to remember, too, like mesh networking is really only feasible on the small scale, like a community-based mesh network.
Well, the current one, sure, you'd have to re-engineer it a little bit and make a... You basically need gateways between mesh networks.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So you're still going to have these bottlenecks of bandwidth and everything like that.
Well, not if you've got a whole... Again, this is where open source software could be handy. If you have these mesh network nodes with open firmware, and you go, okay, well, we've got these two cities where the mesh networks are hitting each other on the edge, why not make every mesh network node that can talk to, you know, every node of another network a gateway? And then just use something like, you know, OSPF or any other routing protocol to just handle that, because TCP will do it. I mean, TCP loves it. The more connections you give it, the better.
Yeah. It'd be nice to actually put together a really robust system that, you know, would be able to... go ahead.
Intel Wi-Fi WiMAX network adapter. $117.99.
Yeah, but that's a client device. How much is it for a WiMAX signal device? Because really, to make it work, I mean, you're talking about mesh networking with WiMAX? That can be done, because mesh networking is a concept. We just apply it to Wi-Fi at the moment, but or 802.11. But
you could do it with Bluetooth if you wanted.
Oh, sure. But if you take it and apply it to something like WiMAX, you could drop that every couple of miles, and then, you know, you're right, it's really nothing to cover the earth in mesh networking. But the problem is the equipment's expensive.
Yeah, and every couple of miles, it's not exactly like that'd be totally feasible for large cities and stuff and along major.
There's all kinds of wilderness
routes,
out there that just fall flat on its face,
not even wilderness, but just smaller communities that are off the beaten path.
That's why WiMAX is nice. Just the range on it's good. Mm. What'd you say, Fox?
I just tied into the power lines. Either put it on the line itself as like a little coupler type thing.
Oh, that's actually what they do around here. There's a mesh network all over the city, and they are literally hanging off the power lines. And you can see they shoot a vampire tap to power the damn things.
Yeah, just pull the power right out of the power lines. They're already, the infrastructure's in place, even in small little shitty rural areas. Yeah. You know, you got a couple mile radius, you put two or three in a town, they're good to go. Mm-hmm. And then in large cities, there's power fucking everywhere. So if you can piggyback off an existing infrastructure, I don't see why it wouldn't work.
Yeah. And considering all things, you generally need a lot of power. Like, I guess the long range ones will, but the shorter range ones won't. And you could easily set them up with little solar stations that would keep them up.
Oh, yeah. Well, what about
majority of the time?
You know, if we are going to tap them into power lines, we already have... I mean, you can buy the kits. They're not that great. But there's already power line networking. So why not, you've got your rural area. And then when you're just making the runs between areas, as opposed to dropping these, mesh network nodes everywhere, because those things are expensive. Although, you could just completely replace the cell phone towers with that. Just, everybody would have little mesh network radios. But why not just drop a high-end power line networking gear as your gateways between areas?
Yeah. And like, that's what being a really robust system would come in really handy, where there's going to be all kinds of different solutions, because it's never going to be just one solution. You're going to have long-range wireless, short-range wireless, you can have actual wired connections, and they should be able to all... mesh together really easily. For example, somebody at their home donating the bandwidth on their cable modem or something like that to the network. Stuff like that.
The only problem with a network like that is it would be very, very difficult to keep it going and not have someone come in and try to regulate it. I mean, they try to regulate, shortwave and ham radios and the citizens bands. And, again, it would become like that, to where eventually the government would be making rules. It wouldn't really have any way to enforce it, because a network like that would be impossible to control. But, when they do catch somebody, of course, they'd black bag them. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the only thing about, going to a power internet just over the lines like that, like most of the lines run by the roadside. So if you kept the wireless, broadcasting around the roadside, like, you could feasibly never lose network connectivity.
Yeah.
Again, replace your cell phones with it. Run a PDA with Skype.
Yeah.
You know, in a lot of communities, they've got new lamps that are solar powered and LED. You could work something like that out too.
Oh yeah.
Oh man, they put new LED lighting in all over where I work, you know, all over the entire campus, and it's funny. I guess they went for some of the lower end ones because they are not nearly as bright as the old lights were. Which I don't get, because LED, usually, when they do it right, you don't notice the difference, or they're even brighter.
But well, they're just so directional. Like, it's really hard to get diffuse.
Well, LED they tried. They've got these things, and it looked like they spent a lot of money on them. But there are these high, bright LED clusters. And then they've got, a light diffusing rope coming out of it and just kind of tacked it down. Along where they used to have all these old fluorescent lights.
Right.
And so when you're near one of the clusters, it's really, you know, they're really bright and you can see them. But they put out, like, no light. You can see the little things, but they don't light up the parking lot they're in at all. It's just really funny. I have no problem with LED lighting. If you're going to go with efficient lighting, LED's probably the way to go. I'm just laughing at these things because they're, like, so gay.
They're pretty good. They've got these plates that are curved, and they're really big diffuses, and it's enough.
Well, the thing about LED lighting is that it's so fragmented right now where there aren't really any standards at this point in time. Like, yeah, the connectors are standard, but the actual way the bulbs actually put out light is not really standardized. And you actually have all these different types of LEDs that do different things. So, you know, you could even go out and buy two bulbs that look identical for LED bulbs, and one it works great and one works like crap and lights your house on fire.
I want the light my house on fire version. That one sounds like fun.
Oh, don't buy the cheap ones. Actually, I think the ones that Walmart sells are the ones that are known for lighting on fire.
Another reason
some
not
of the
to
circuitry in them is somewhat sketchy.
Now,
but
Think Geek was selling an LED lighting kit that you actually had a little remote control for, and you could change the colors. And I almost ordered a set of those.
I actually ordered one of those for my sister for, it was like, oh, yeah, she signed up for that Reddit Secret Santa thing, and she got shafted, so I got her that to make her feel better. But it was a pile of junk. The remote control wouldn't really even work.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'm glad I didn't
order
them.
Not nearly as cool as it looks.
So I said, that looked awesome. It'd be like, you know, have a couple of remotes and walk in a room, and I'm feeling blue today, so I'll make it blue in this room. That'd screw with the color calibration on your monitors, though, there, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Now, in those things, they didn't put out very much light. Like, it was very short range. Like, it would be enough to shine on something on a shelf.
Like a lamp.
Yeah.
That's not nearly as fun. Did anybody else go get the black light bulbs when they were kids and change all the lights in their room to black light?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Those things were awesome. But they were never as good as the actual fluorescent black lights.
I had a few of those, too.
It lets you keep your lights on and, like, keep working on something at night without, like, light showing underneath your door.
Yeah. Well, that was always fun. Of course, too, you walk in the room, oh, wow, my shirt's dirty. So, I mean...
But the paint on those bulbs blocks all infrared. So the bulbs get really, really, really hot. Don't try to touch.
Yeah, they do.
I'm pretty sure I actually managed to remove my fingerprints on one of those one time.
I never quite did that, although that was right up there with cooking the hot dog in the AMD K6-2. True story, fun story here, just to, you know, end up the show with. We got, like, what, 4 minutes left, 3 minutes left?
All right.
Buddy of mine, back in high school, early high school, like freshman year, decided he wanted to build a computer, and he knew I'd built a couple. So he ordered his parts, and when he got them in, he said, okay, we're going to have a LAN party, and at the LAN party, we'll build my computer. I'm like, okay, cool. So I show up, and we start to put his computer together, and he had already gotten excited and couldn't wait, so he was starting to put it together, and he couldn't get the video card to work. And I'm looking at it. He's shoehorning this thing into a 386 case, because he didn't buy a case, because he knew he had one. This is like the tank computer case that old IBMs used to come in, right?
Oh.
Yeah. And so his dad, who was an army engineer, was making this work, right? By, like, drilling out holes in the case and JB welding in standoffs, and there was cork in there so shit wouldn't short out. Oh, this was classic, right? And I'll tell you later, long after we got that machine built, he was still using that case, and it had heating problems, and it was the perfect size just to take a little cheap box fan and take the cover off and just set the box fan down on top of this case, and it was perfect. And, because it was a desktop case, right? And, you know, that's what he did for cooling for that thing for a very long time. But when he ordered his parts, one, he didn't order a heat sink for this AMD K62. It was a 300 megahertz chip. Right. And, well, first he was having problems with video card. And we messed with it, and we messed with it. And I got mad at it and smacked the video card, and it just goes chink. And it was like the last three pins weren't fully touching. Now I'm describing some pretty noobish mistakes, but you got to understand this was back when I was still learning. So, anyways, you know, it's like, oh yeah, unseat, reseat the video card. That would have fixed that. But anyways, so we get working on it, and I'm realizing there's no heat sink on his processor. And I ask him about it. He goes, "Well, it didn't come with one, so I didn't think it needed it." No, I'm pretty sure it does.
And you say it was actually running before this?
Oh, yeah. Well, this is before they were putting the temperature sensors in them.
Okay.
So you could light it on fire if you kept it going without the heatsink long enough. It gets better. So, of course, I'm like, well, no, man, you're going to melt your processor. So he sticks his finger on it. Burns the shit out of his finger, screams. Because, you know, this thing had to be, like, you know, 120 degrees, 140 degrees, something like that. It didn't have a sensor on it, so it wasn't beeping or anything. And it was running. And so he comes back with a hot dog, or half of one anyways. Cooks a freaking hot dog on his processor. And he eats it.
That's an expensive hot dog cooker.
Oh, no, wow. The processor was still working. It gets better. So... we had drank a lot of.
Well.
Oh yeah, we had drank a lot of Mountain Dew and Dr. Pepper by this point because it was like 1 a.m, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, dude, we've got to find some way to cool this processor so you can play Quake 2, and because it was crashing, obviously, from the heat. And I look at all these Coke cans sitting around, and I'm thinking we could make a heat sink out of this. And my buddy, his first name was Dan. I'll tell you that, Dan. He goes, wait, I've got a better idea. So he runs off with two of them. And I hear the water running in the kitchen.
Oh, God.
Oh, it gets better. So he then puts the Coke cans in the freezer. And he says, I put hot water in them, so we only need to wait about half an hour.
Mm-hmm. Oh, God.
So we wait half an hour. We play Magic for about an hour, actually. And we go check them, and sure enough, they're frozen. So we have the two Coke cans. And we start playing Quake 2. And actually, he played Final Fantasy VII doing this as well. And about every 20 minutes, he would take a dish towel, wipe down the condensation from the mainboard, and switch out the frozen Coke can that was cooling his processor. Ladies and gentlemen, we phase-changed cooled a computer processor in 1998.
Oh, wow.
Winning.
Yeah, hats off to you.
I thought you'd enjoy that one. So, totally true story, too. It's great. And I to this day, I don't know how the hell we didn't short out that main board, cooking a hot dog on it, and phase change cooling the processor with Dr. Pepper cans.
The grease from the hot dog kept a barrier to keep the water away from the circuitry. And
well, the next day, we go to Radio Shack to get a heat sink, because we've got to have a heat sink for this thing, right? And this was before they were carrying computer part heat sinks and really computer parts. And he had his dad with him. And his dad, of course, army engineer. He knew what he was doing with electronics. And this processor needs a heat sink. This chip needs a heat sink. So he buys like four of those little transistor heat sinks, the kind you're supposed to bolt onto the like voltage regulators.
Yep.
And a glob, you know, a little tube of heatsink putty. and heat sink putties on four transistor heat sinks onto this thing, then takes a and takes the box fan, puts the box fan on there. It was a month before he ordered a decent heat sink for this thing.
Wow.
And it worked fine. Awesome. Kicked ass at Red Alert 2 with that build. So
yeah, it would have been running a little hot with that, but with those older processors, it would have been fine.
It worked. Like,
you try that with a processor from nowadays.
And, oh, yeah, it just dies.
Yeah.
So with that, guys, we are out of time, so I'm going to play a couple of tracks here.
My naked chest on my chair now.
Freak out, red light, freak out. Oh my God.